ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When was the last time you really looked at your kettle, your umbrella, the hallway mirror, or even a gravestone? Every one of them was designed by someone for a reason. And those choices are still shaping how you live. The ordinary isn't ordinary at all. That's By Design with me, Anthony Burke. Find it on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The ocean covers more than 70% of the planet. And artificial intelligence is helping us understand it and its inhabitants in ways we never could before.
It should be called the planet water. And scientists are teaching computers to spot sharks and map the ocean floor. And one day we may even decipher whale conversations.
Wonder what they're saying about us, Robin. Today on The Science Show, will AI help shape conservation efforts?
Or are marine scientists handing over too much power to these algorithms? The Pope, in fact, warned against AI's power this week. And Professor Toby Walsh of the University of New South Wales wrote similarly on its vast expense and energy requirements. What next? I'm Robin Williams.
And I'm Belinda Smith. Now, Robin, have a listen to this.
Politicians and people who've never worked in science don't understand that there's not a straight-line relationship between scientific invention and innovation and producing products. It sometimes takes 20 or 30 years.
That was Dame Bridget Ogilvie, who died in April. And those words are just as relevant today as they were back in 1997, just after Bridget was made a Dame Commander of the Order of the British Empire. She was a renowned parasitologist and former director of the Wellcome Trust in the UK, where she was one of the most influential figures in British research and worldwide.
But did you know, Belle, that Dame Ogilvie was born in the northern New South Wales town of Glen Innes?
Huh.
In 2012, I asked her how a farm girl became head of one of the biggest health research outfits in the UK, providing, thanks to her, more funding for medical research than the whole British government.
We had a sheep property, fine wool, and my father was a very unusual man for his generation. He was at Balliol College, Oxford, which was a transforming experience for him, so I feel deeply indebted to that institution. And the family actually had a history of educating women. Two of my father's sisters had degrees. So as far as the father and my mother were concerned, there was just no question about it. If they had a bright child, whether male or female, they'd get on.
So being a country girl, you got into the field quite often and got to know the animals?
Well, of course. I mean, I really did spend a lot of time on the farm, mustering and enjoying myself helping on the farm with the dogs and all that kind of thing. And the question that formulated in my mind really then, which came to fruition in my research career, was how come you could vaccinate so successfully against Clostridia with one shot, but with helminths, they kept on persisting no matter how often you treated them with antihelmintics or if they're external parasites with insecticides. So that really was an incredible influence at a very young age when I was a primary school child.
But most primary school kids don't think like that. Did your friends think like that at all?
Well, you see, because it was during the war, I didn't have any school friends until I went to my primary school. And we didn't play after school because nobody had petrol and all the rest of it. So it was in some ways an isolated existence, but yeah, I was as happy as a duck doing all this kind of thing. I mean, I didn't formally formulate that idea when I was a child, but by the time I got to university, looking back, it had a huge influence on me. And I was very lucky because not only was I lucky enough to have a family with this history of education, but I went to the local primary school, which was a one teacher, one room bush school with a really brilliant teacher. The State Department of Education wanted him to go to a bigger school, but he liked being a single teacher. And there were four in my class, Johnny Pilling, Vincent Winter, Neil Hamilton and me. And what he did was to use the brighter children to help him. So he then put more attention on the kids who were struggling. And those of us like me who were brighter than probably than the average will help the others, you see.
Brilliant idea, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a classic, apparently, in educational circles. This is classic. So by the time we all got to high school, all four in my class were well ahead from the primary curriculum. So, I mean, what a stroke of luck. Family and this brilliant teacher. I mean, he was an extraordinary man. And thankfully, because when you're that age, you think anybody over the age of 18 is Methuselah. So I had no idea how old he was at that time. And about 20 years ago, I thought, I must see if this guy is still alive. So I managed to track him down in a home when he was over 19. I wrote to him, really to thank him. And I had this sweet letter back saying, of course I remember you. I remember all the children who went through my hands. And he said a few things which made me realize he did. And then he said, I broke my wrist a while ago and my writing's changed, but it hadn't. And then he said, P.S., your brother Bill really wanted to be left-handed, but I persuaded him to be right-handed. Is he still right-handed?
Oh, wow.
Sadly, he died 2 weeks before I had paid my next visit to Australia. But he was a brilliant guy, actually. I mean, you wouldn't pass him in the street, you wouldn't notice, but what a teacher. So that incredible strength. And quite frankly, after that, didn't much matter what happened to me educationally because you have such a sound training.
Isn't that interesting? Those magical teachers come up again and again in these interviews. One wonders, what if they hadn't been there? What if they hadn't turned up? Would your career have been different?
Exactly, because I went to a boarding school after that for my secondary education, and whilst there were two or three very good teachers, most of them were pretty ordinary, to put it mildly.
That was Negs, wasn't it?
Yes. It didn't really matter, though, because I'd learned to work by myself, and no matter what happened, I could get on with it. And, of course, in those days, when you went to university, it wasn't nearly as selective as it is now. And, of course, my dear father was regarded as a deeply eccentric man, sending a daughter to university. I mean, a son would have been strange enough in that environment. And his bank manager one day called him in and said, look at all these red lines here, because if you're in the negative, everything was in the red, you may remember, and your accounts. And you're spending money on your daughter's university and education. You should be spending it on more fertilizer, John. And John said to him, well, Fred, as a matter of fact, finest form of fertilizer I know. So wasn't I lucky.
Did you sail through science at school?
We had chemistry and biology and maths, but no physics. And fortunately for me, the chemistry teaching was pretty lousy until the last 6 months before the leaving certificate, as it was in those days. And that teacher, who came in at about Easter, was one of the really brilliant ones. She just finished doing her dip ed after her undergraduate degree, and she instantly transformed the subject. It was extraordinary. She was a truly brilliant teacher, and the half dozen of us who was doing chemistry all got through very well because of her. And I went back 2 or 3 years later to see her and thank her, and she died of leukemia. Would you believe it? I mean, you know, she was Dorothy Shepherd, her name was. She transformed the subject. It was extraordinary. Whereas the maths teacher wasn't very good, so I had to plough through more maths when I became an undergraduate.
Indeed, at the University of New England?
No, I started at the University of Queensland, actually.
You went to Queensland first, I didn't realise
that. To do straight science, and I found it deeply boring because it was all systematics, and this wasn't what I was in the university to do. And
then classification of...
Yes, deadly boring, actually. I mean, it's important, but to me it was just so boring. And then I read about this new course at the University of New England, rural science, at the Easter holidays. And I thought, this was much more my speed. So I went down to see the founding dean, Bill McClymont. And I remember, well, he was thrilled. He said, oh, yes, he said, they're all men, you know. And he was a vet, actually. And he knew that in years in veterinary science, where there was no woman, the men didn't work very hard. And I didn't know any of this. And I remember him throwing himself back in his office chair, putting his feet up on the desk, and he said, yes, he said, if you get through those subjects, you can come and join this class in its second year. That'll make the so-and-sos work.
Dame Bridget Ogilvie, who died in April, aged 88. I'll remember her for her sharp wit and also as a fierce advocate for science. She was in charge of science communication at the Royal Society of London, and it really made a difference. Fewer po-faced notables talking above our heads, and more scientists, as they really are, being passionate about science for all of us. And you can hear more on that from Bridget Ogilvie herself as we repeat the special we did on The Science Show. That's coming up in the summer season.
That's a great episode, Robin. And this is The Science Show on ABC Radio National. Now for the topic that's infiltrated pretty much everything, including science, artificial intelligence.
Yes, Professor Toby Walsh, Chief Scientist at the University of New South Wales AI Institute, published an opinion piece in the Australian Financial Review last week, not only warning of the economic cost of AI, but also the environmental and cultural effects.
Even Nature had a special out about AI in science. featuring how it's drastically accelerating drug discovery research, but also asking questions like, if AI does all the grunt work of science, are trainee scientists missing out on practical experience?
Nature is even, that's the journal, running a poll asking researchers their thoughts on using AI.
What are your thoughts on it, Robin?
I'm worried.
Yeah.
But some marine scientists have already embraced AI in their work.
So what are these AI tools doing, and how might they be used in the future? This was the topic of a panel discussion held at the Australian National Maritime Museum earlier this year called Can AI Talk Whale? Hosted by museum curator Emily Jatiff.
Welcome to the Maritime Museum. This is Can AI Talk Whale? I'm Emily Jatiff, the museum's curator of Ocean Futures, and your MC tonight. Now, what do you get when you put an ARIA winner, a Eureka Prize winner, and a Telstra Queensland Businesswoman of the Year on stage together to talk about artificial intelligence and the future of our ocean? You are about to find out. But before we get started, to set the scene for us, we need someone with a deep understanding of these issues. And so I would like to welcome to the stage author, scientific futurist, global XPRIZE visioneer, and expert in cybernetics, Associate Professor Dr. Catherine Ball.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So as a futurist, I have to try and throw balls around the room. And the first one I'll say is, can everyone remember about 10 years ago? I mean, the internet's been going a little bit crazy on the idea of 2016. So can everyone think about where they were in 2016? Now I want you to take that time and I want us to go forward. And it's 19th of February, 2036. And I'm about to read you the news from the future. After a decade of AI-assisted bioacoustics, the International Court today has recognized certain cetaceans as legal persons, not as symbolism or as activism, but as evidence-based governance. And the groundwork was laid by projects over the last decade that already exist in perpetuity. Project SETI, CETI, spent years off Dominica building the largest high-resolution dataset of sperm whale codex in the world, combining underwater robotics, biologging tags, and machine learning to model the structure in whale communication. The Earth Species Project, just off of Dominica, began training foundation models for animal sounds, moving beyond species recognition towards generalizable bioacoustic intelligence. Then there was Google DeepMind with their Dolphin Gemma-style sequence models that helped analyze dolphin vocal patterns, treating acoustic structure with the same seriousness as human language modeling. Meanwhile, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute advanced their Whale SETI, S-E-T-I, explicitly using whale communication as a methodological sandbox for recognizing non-human intelligence, whether in the ocean or in deep space. At the same time, Breakthrough Listen refined AI-driven anomaly detection across radio telescope data, applying similar pattern recognition frameworks at a cosmic scale. And here's what changed in 2036. It isn't perfect translation, it was interaction. In controlled playback experiments, a generated signal structured as identity plus proximity plus non-threat is emitted. The whales responded. Then they modified. Then they corrected. Then they made a fart joke. The pattern stabilized across replications, identity markers persisted, dialect clusters held, social coordination signals aligned, and observed behavior was proven. At that point, the legal question became unavoidable. If a species can demonstrate structured communication, cultural transmission, identifiable individuals, and coordinated social decision-making, what exactly would possibly disqualify it from personhood? So now today, on the 19th of February 2036, shipping lanes are being redrawn. Military sonar requires acoustic consent zones. Ocean governance councils have been formed. But the real disruption isn't maritime. It's philosophical. We have kids learning the Gold Coast Migaloota sentence dialect in Gold Coast classrooms. Because once we recognise that non-human intelligence on Earth is legally real, SETI's premise for deep space stops being speculative. If we can detect structured intelligence in whales, we can refine how we search the stars. And if whales can qualify as persons by the 19th of February 2036, then the next question isn't just about oceans. It's about boundaries. What counts as intelligence? What counts as a person? And who or what could be next? Thank you.
I love you. You blow my mind. It's great. How was that for an intro, yeah? Everybody now terrified of whales? No. I'm going to bring each one of the panelists up on stage for just a couple of questions to get to know them and their relationship with AI, and then we'll have a big panel event at the end. So, Catherine, I love reading your bio. You use such cool words like visioneer and scientific futurist. So I'd like to know, what is a scientific futurist?
Well, it's a terrible thing when you're a bit polymathic like me and you have a number of doctorates and various degrees that if someone says to you, so who are you and what do? You start giving a soliloquy in Shakespearean fashion where you sound like a right dingbat by the end of it, you know, to use a polite term. And so it's really difficult for scientists, I think, sometimes to name what it is that they do. And the word futurist is quite easily digestible by most folks. And so I thought futurist is a really good way to think about the predictive work that I do, though I'm Catherine Ball, not Crystal Ball. thank you. So I try, like a lot of scientists and technologists do, to try and see what's coming over the horizon. But I do that with cybernetic frameworks and scientific frameworks. I don't do it just as guesswork or a way of journalistically referring in a derivative fashion as to what I see. I try to create new thoughts and new ideas and new propositions to how the world could
well
be.
Well explained. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ding, ding.
And as someone who has a deep understanding of the challenges and opportunities that are present in the application of AI, how do you personally use it?
Well, I have to just ask everybody in this room, who is regularly using AI on a day-to-day basis? Who would say they use it once a week? Maybe once a month? Who's never touched an AI? There's always a couple, it's all right. I use AI for lots of different things. I've actually created a company using AI deepfakes to present and to do corporate engagement and to do public speaking engagements. So for example, if they want me in Frankfurt, but I'm in Las Vegas, they get my clone, whoever pays the lowest fee. And one of the reasons why I did that was because of all the deepfakes in the world, 80% of them are derogatory against women, children, or their pornography. And so how do I, as a woman of science and technology, take ownership of technology? I take ownership of technology. And so I'm working with a wonderful Tasmanian and Queensland-based Australian organization called UMimic, who are Hollywood-style directors, like really proper Hollywood-qualified directors. And we're creating lifelike clones. And my next stage of this, which is yet to be released, is CathGPT, which you can ask me questions. And I feel like I need to launch in Mona in the ladies' lounge, though. I need to talk to Kersha about that one, to talk about feminist scientific theory. But the idea, too, is I tried playing with that, not to be a coder on it, and I can write code, but that wasn't the point. The point was, how can I apply this? So I've created one using Lovable, which is a really great platform for you to say, you might have a household budget or a weekly sports schedule when you need to work out your washing, or you might have a car that you need to manage a certain way. You can create an app that is your own personal family management app using something like Lovable. You can create a whole new way that maybe people who are of a particular language need to interact with government terminology. But Lovable's a great app. Another way I use it is I have two editors and research associates that I actually produced a publishing company. I actually created a publishing company on Tuesday and
did
I published a book yesterday.
Did you say I created a publishing company on Tuesday?
Yes. Yes, I did. Yes, on Tuesday. I said to my husband, can I create another business? He went, yes, all right then. So I created a publishing company and I've managed to unpick and unpeel how the publishing world works. And so I'm writing a number of books at the moment and I published Future of Sleep yesterday for release on Kindle tomorrow. And I actually worked over that a number of months with two research associates overnight called ChatGPT Pro and Google Gemini Pro. And they did not write a single word of that book. They did not have a single idea in that book. But when I was trying to figure out the origins of a certain form of microbe on the International Space Station, they were a really great research associate for me. So I am not afraid. I have an AI declaration on all of my work to say, I am trying these tools, but ultimately I am in charge. They are not producing anything. I am using them to do the things that I want to do.
And that's the incredibly important thing to remember, is that it's human-driven at its core, and the human behind it is the one who makes the decision.
So what about the ocean?
It's a really good question, because you know what? A lot of things in the academic world, and we know this, it takes a long time for them to get published. It takes a long time for them to get produced. And so I only know from scratching on the edges of some of the work that I've seen from scientists actually involved directly putting things into the water. But we have historical data sets that people are using now to build this idea of change management. So how do you look at before and after change indices? How do you pick up the key markers or the warning signs that we're getting from the ocean that something might be wrong? And so we have to look back to the data. It'll come down to the data. So fisheries management have used data science, and then were probably the earliest purveyors of artificial based intelligence, because they have a financial value behind the fisheries. The deep ocean floor mapping, that was the Ocean Discovery X Prize 10 years ago that I was a judge on, that's now seabed2030.org, which was probably going to be seabed2035.org when we think about it. They are using a lot of different multimodal techniques for the measurement of the seafloor at different resolutions. And so how do you get apples to talk to oranges? And one way is you produce a wonderful translation system inside an artificial intelligence. So it's really interesting seeing some of these large historical and contemporary data sets from the ocean being now analysed using these AI platforms. You have AI-enabled loggers. If I was to go really deep to it, we have cables, big ships laying cables, right? So we're going to have more and more cables on that seafloor. Some of those cables have sensors on them that are so sensitive that they can pick up what kind of vessel and what kind of animal might be moving around them. You can use them for defense, you can use them for conservation, you can use them for oceanography and tides and swirls and things. But, you know, because ocean data has always been so rich and diverse, it's been the place that the mathematics really started getting their teeth into these things. And so I think about David Mearns as the shipwreck hunter on the hunt for the HMAS Sydney in the 90s. And he had to go to the CSIRO and they had to do their ocean modelling and take it all the way back to the Battle of the Cormoran versus the Sydney some 60 years ago, and then reenact where the currents might have taken her in order for him to find her.
Yeah, we still do that now.
You still do that now. So you see, that for me is the precursor of huge multimodal data sets in a confined system that we're parametric, or we're guessing almost.
Generally, AI pro, anti?
AI's here and it's not going away. So you have to decide whether or not you want to be part of it or not, quite frankly. And I'm not about to go and live in a tree.
Excellent.
So I think that the key here thing, we can't shy away from some of these technologies that are so powerful and going to affect every single one of our lives. We can't sit back and let the government regulate it. We can't sit back and let the companies make money from it. We have to get educated on it so we can tell our MPs how they represent us in Parliament when we want to start regulating these technologies. All I know at the moment is some of the disease research and drug discovery that's coming out from a human health perspective is mind-boggling, to the point where diseases that we thought we would never have cures for, we're now talking about having cures. That communicable diseases we never thought we'd have vaccines for, we're thinking about having vaccines for. And so for me, AI has enabled us to have massive conversations, but I am going to put an asterisk. I don't think all of us are having those conversations. And it's not because we're necessarily illiterate, but it is because we don't know what the potential of the technology is. But we could learn and we could understand that. And our government here in Australia and many other governments around the world have not educated their populace about what AI is and what it could potentially mean, which means we don't know how to point and shoot
at it. Let's start that conversation tonight. Thank you so much, Cass.
Yes, thank you. All right, see you in a minute.
Now, please join me in welcoming to the stage award-winning comedian, author, actor, and radio presenter Matt O'Keen. Welcome, Matt. Thank you. Now, Matt, when it comes to AI, I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that you might be a bit of a normie like me in this space.
Yeah, I don't use AI. I'm not scared of it. I'm untrustworthy of it, to be completely honest. You know, in the arts, it's the enemy. There's this machine that just takes things from you and doesn't necessarily give back as much, or the value that it gives back to you as an artist isn't necessarily as much. So I'm very conscious of what I put into AI, of what I want to give it, because my life revolves around the lie, the not truths.
Stories.
Yeah, but you know, that's it. It's things that didn't happen. So anytime I put something that didn't happen into an AI you know, a bot or anything like that, there's the risk that it will learn it and then replicate it for when someone else wants to write a story. So it'll use my likeness to train a radio personality to sound like me and talk like me and tell jokes like me, which is what happens now. So there's a couple of companies at the moment who have been in a little bit of trouble for, say, the weather presenter is actually an AI bot. It's just, it's not a real person, or it's modeled off one news reader in Dubbo, and then they've made the same person all around Australia. Or there was a online digital radio station who didn't tell people they were doing it, but had a completely fake AI announcer announcing the songs and everything like that. So while the corporations are testing the waters to figure out how much people will accept, I'm not willing to feed it anymore at this stage.
I can understand that. Jobs, you think about that radio presenter who could have been the radio presenter.
I always think of it the same way I look at furniture or fast food. People are going to go for McDonald's, or they're going to buy something from IKEA. And just because that is mass-produced, machine-driven, basically cut-and-print, robot-style making, doesn't mean that it's not of value, but it certainly means that it's not as valuable. Whereas the finely crafted, handmade piece of furniture from the guy in Italy who's been doing it for 80 years, it's going to be worth more to some people. And there's room for both of those things in this world. It's just, I want my storytelling to be handmade, and I want people to know that it came from me and it was invented by me, not prompted by a million other me's around the world.
What would be your response to some of the things that she said in her 5 minutes there?
Look, to be honest, what I would really love AI to be able to do when it comes to the ocean is just tell me when there's jellyfish around. That's all I care about. I hate jellyfish. I hate blue bottles. Every time I'm getting ready to go to the beach, if I walk down on the sand and I see a blue bottle on the water, I'm turning around, I'm going back. Like, I hate it. You know what I mean? I don't want to be yelling, begging to be on by someone stranger just because I've had a jellyfish slapped across my face. So just tell me how I can know if there's jellyfish in there.
Safety.
That's
safety.
It. That's all I want to know.
Help the human.
Yes. Every time I look at, like, I go down to the beach and I see, you know, I ask the lifesaver, like, what's going on here? And they're like, oh, mate, can't you see? Yeah, there's obviously a very clear rip here. And I look, it's just ocean, man. I don't know what I'm looking. It's just water. I don't see a rip. So give me like an app where I can just like hold it up and I can see every single thing. And I'm like, oh, okay, I definitely won't go in there. That looks like a rip. But so those are the sort of things that I would love to see in AI and the ocean. Consumer level things.
Practical applications.
Yeah. And all, you know, and just like a little chip in my board shorts that just goes, hey, shark, we cool. Like, I'm here, you're here. We don't need to duke it out, bro. Like, we're just let's both enjoy this together.
Be speaking shark language from your pocket.
Yeah, absolutely. That's all. Just like a little, you know, like it's just letting someone know.
That's what you desire from AI. But when you think about AI in the ocean, how do you think it's being used right now?
Tracking where things are going, how things are repopulating, areas that would be useful for fishing and fishing sustainability, fastest way for boats to move around the ocean, where sources of certain chemicals are coming from really deep, far underneath the ocean that might tell us more about what's happening in the deeper seas. Those are the only things I can imagine. But also, it would be great to get an AI robot to clean the pool every now and then as well. That would be a really good one, not one that just keeps going over the leaves. You know, that's what I would imagine AI and the ocean are doing.
I agree with you. It's very similar to the land. For the arts, I don't want them to do the fun stuff. I want to do the fun stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
I want you to load my dishwasher.
Exactly. I mean, the exploitation of AI is what I'm really, I love AI. I love the idea of AI. It's the people behind it that I absolutely do not trust. I did a documentary on the ABC recently about death. There are whole companies that are set up to create a bot of you to exist as a legacy piece after you die. And you can train it over years, or you can train it over lots of big interviews where you can say all the things that happened to you in your life. You give it a full A to Z of every experience you had, so that when you're kids sit down or your grandkids sit down, they can go, tell me what it was like when growing up. And your bot says, well, I walked to school and I used to go down this road and it was like this and it was like that. And that sounds really great in theory, but you already know that there's going to be some young child whose dad died when he was 2 years old, who finally grows old enough and gets to talk to this person that he's got so many questions for, that this lost life and youth that he would love to understand and know more of. And he'll sit down opposite this bot of his dad who he doesn't know anything about and say, tell me what it was like. How did you feel when you saw me getting born? And the bot will say, I will tell you that as soon as you try these Ray-Ban sunglasses on. You know, it'll make your day so much brighter. And if you want to hear the full story, you buy the primo version of me, your dad. You know what I mean? Like, that's 100,000,000% happen. And I hate the idea of the people behind this doing everything they can to just squeeze us.
It's not the AI, it's the humans behind it.
Yeah.
It's always us. Oh, thank you so much,
anyways,
Matt.
That's
I really
just me.
Appreciate it. And now let's bring it deep into the ocean with wildlife biologist, author, science communicator, and museum research associate, Dr. Vanessa Parada. Hi, Vanessa. Thank you. Who is also frequently on your television as she keeps us up to date with what migrating whales up and down our coast, all their trials and tribulations.
Yes, there are many.
Which is great. Now, Vanessa, how are biologists and ecologists applying AI to understanding marine species and environments?
Well, but when it comes to whales, gone are the days where you still do this. You get an underwater microphone called a hydrophone. Plunk. Feed it down, and then and then you'd go back to your computer screen and you go, okay, I can see this and then this. But with AI, you can have computers look at it and go, there's a pattern here, there's a pattern here. Oh, so-and-so said this last year. That's what it means. So it's helping us understand the data that we've always been collecting just in a more efficient way. And that goes back to the medical component. So breast cancer checks, I've heard that that's been, you know, the use of AI. I'm a whale scientist, I don't know about that. But just it's helping us see the information we gathered or weren't able to interpret properly in a more efficient way.
And bulk data can be analysed
bulk
much
data,
faster.
Oh my
yeah?
gosh. So in the ocean, it's big. We know more about the world above us than we do about the sea. So that's why I'm always talking about the need to learn more about the ocean, which is so important. But yes, there's so much data that comes out of the ocean that we just don't necessarily have research assistants to deal with. We need bulk interpretation. And so that can be really helpful. But also, the skills that we have as scientists should never fade away. We need those skills because we need to interpret the information in the most appropriate way. And I too am a little bit afraid of AI when it comes to those kind of things. I think we need a Professor Ball with us all the time to go, that's BS, that's all right. So I'm still interpreting it, but I'm really lucky. I feel personally privileged to have gone through university and done all I've had without AI because I'm a little old school. I prefer not using it. Yeah. But then also I'm like, well, I've written this 10 times. Can you rewrite this and make me sound better? And it works. So I see the benefits, but I'm very cautious here sitting in how we interpret information from the ocean. And a lot of this and the questions that we want to ask requires investment. And investment in marine research in Australia is pretty bad.
So AI can really overcome a lot of those
challenges. Well, we hope.
Some.
Yeah.
And so as a marine scientist, did you ever think that you would be using AI?
I never thought I'd be using AI. And I can tell you a very bizarre way is because when I finished my PhD in 2019, I said no to a postdoctoral position in Canada because I wanted to stay here and do the things, whatever you have to do, have your calves. And one of the jobs that I was working on, and I still am now the chief scientist on, this is my other job that did involve whales. I know, can you believe it? Whales don't pay much. Just letting you know. So it was essentially using AI to detect illegal wildlife trafficking. I never in a million years thought that I would be doing that. And so now I'm sitting here saying that my team and I, Taronga Zoo, Rapid Scan Systems, and the Department of Environment, Federal, have created world-first detection algorithms for the detection of lizards, birds and fish in male pathways. And we've evolved that research with a marine focus, which I can't talk about because it's under review right now. So the process is long, but I never thought I'd be using AI. Actually, I am using AI for whale research. We can tell the difference between Jack or Jenny the whale by using its tail flukes. So every whale has a unique tail, and every single whale tail is like a fingerprint. Each are different. And so using AI via a platform called Happy Whale, you're able to take a photo of your whale tail, and luckily they can go, yep, this is this whale, this is that whale, or this is a whale that we're seeing in East Antarctica, you've now seen it over here. It's amazing. We used to do that just by looking at it.
The photographs.
That's right, but with AI it's easier. And so AI is now helping us as well understand Brutus whales in Australian waters, which are a really unknown whale. They have a pointy mouth and they've got dorsal fins like dolphins, and we're using that to help us understand and create the first catalogue of Brutus whales.
So it really speeds up
which is
research.
Very exciting. Oh my gosh. Sorry, I just seen people I know. I need AI as well to go.
They understand what you're talking about. That's they right. know. The wildlife tracking, that's phenomenal research. Now, that wouldn't be possible without AI technology?
AI is helpful in terms of interpreting the data. As we sit here right now, we have, for example, my friend Dr. Clive McMahon in Antarctica has elephant seals with data loggers on their head right now in Antarctica collecting oceanographic data. They're going around, coming up, having a fight, then feeding, then having a sleep. All of these things are happening right now. I personally don't have any tags out on whales, but there would be tagged whales right now swimming around. And we're kind of at a point where a lot of the questions we ask as scientists has to go through ethics. So are you okay to place this on a whale, getting close with a boat, embedding something into an animal, where science is like going away from that. So the questions we ask may really come about through visual interpretation, so data collection through vision, through acoustic detection, and then AI will be really strong in that capacity.
I get it. So you're minimizing the physical interference with the animal through using AI.
Yes. Ha. That's a great, and you've just nailed that. Well done.
Okay. And that's something that the scientific community is a big fan of.
Yes.
Great. I get it, everyone.
Yeah. Yes. You get a fish.
That's that's fantastic. So I'll ask you the same question that I asked Kath. AI, anti or pro?
Can I be a fence sitter? AI is literally helping us as Australia protect our wildlife through the ability to detect illegal wildlife trafficking. And that's thanks to AI. It can help us work out the difference between a banana and a lizard really efficiently. That is amazing. And then the other side of me is I'm now very much a proud university lecturer at Macquarie Uni. And so that means that I would hope that those students don't rely on AI too much, because we want them to be really good students in the future and we don't want them to be cheating and doing things like that. So we like AI, but it must be used in when it needs to be used.
Informed use.
Informed use.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Vanessa.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Now, we are going to have a couple of questions here, obviously. So what we've done is we've had a chat about the current state of play, and now we're going to go back and look to the future. So I would like to start out by talking about, can AI talk whale, and all those slightly exciting and terrifying things that you mentioned. And as Kath mentioned, there are global scientific groups like Project SETI that are using AI to decode whale language. So let's chat all together about the real life ramifications that we can see in cross species communication, because we don't really have that yet. I mean, my cat doesn't really know what I'm saying. So what happens if your whale knows what you're saying, Vanessa?
So when you talk about that, it's all really cool to know what whales are saying. But as a scientist, I'm sitting here going, that's really good. But we've got a whale in Victorian waters right now that's entangled in fishing gear that needs to be helped. We've got all these other pressing issues that probably don't seem as cool. But I, as a scientist, it frustrates me. We need to help, need to work on practical solutions right now, working with fishers, working with the shipping industry to try and minimise entanglement or ship strike, acoustic pollution, all these problems that we don't think about. And here as a scientist, I'm going, you know, decoding what they're saying, or if you can, is really cool.
Yeah.
But I personally, my jam is to kind of help out the animals.
It's not
that
a
we
priority.
Until you've got 10,000 whales all going, clean up your rubbish here right now. clean up.
Yeah.
Why did you call me sperm? That's what I would say. Why did, I don't look anything like it.
Did you know what sounds they make? They make the loudest sound in the animal world, louder than a 747 taking off. Oh, over really? 240 decibels.
How far can you hear it?
Well, it depends. So that's high frequency sound. High frequency sound is high but travels shorter. Low frequency sound.
So they go...
No, it's like a
that actually translates to, oh, sorry, I didn't mean to do that so quickly. Sorry, it's not usually that sensitive.
Sing a song. It's only the males. And the song they sing this year is really cool, but it's kind of like the hottest 100. Next year won't be cool here.
Have they got a new song every year?
The males will change their sexual repertoire in calling the ladies.
So that's like a crooning kind of thing.
Keep it fresh. It's interesting though, because legally, if you think about the frameworks, what would actually provide protection to the whales that are entangled is personhood. And so legally, personhood of non-humans is something we're already seeing. We've seen representation of rivers, representation of particular areas of nature, and now we're also almost about to have personhood given to certain whale species. And a lot of this is actually coming from indigenous knowledge and indigenous empowerment of legal frameworks. So if you actually think to unentangle a whale, it's not a moral question. It's a financial
true as well.
And so if you could turn a financial imperative into rescuing Fred, our mate, who's trapped in there, who insures the whales? Who insures the entanglement? And so welcome to a brand new paradigm of wildlife insurance and species insurance and asset insurance and the redrawing of borders. Because as soon as someone is given legal personhood, you have habeas corpus. And as soon as you have habeas corpus, mate, you've got lawyers. And as soon as you've got lawyers, you've got money. And as soon as you've got money, you've got insurance. And as soon as you've got insurance, you've got finance. And then the fintech bros are in town. And then suddenly a whale that's entangled in Victoria is worth something, not morally, worth something economically, not as a nice to have, but as a pain if you don't look after it. And it's the carrot and stick debate that we have heard about Mother Nature and the valuing of Mother Nature's services since I wrote my PhD thesis like 20 odd years ago. How do you value ecosystem services, or how do you value a whale? You have to give it some kind of economic benefit transfer value. If you can't do that by its ecosystem services, you do it by how much you're going to be fined if
which
you
hurt which is what we're trying
one.
To do across and the entire so, ocean.
And but that's interesting right because what we have a national and international obligation to protect our native flora and fauna. So we actually need to do that anyway, but there's no money for marine research. We know that. The other thing I run is the Tongan Whale Tourism Project in the Kingdom of Tonga, because what you're talking about is essentially an asset coming to a place to migrate that people will pay a lot of money to swim with. But if we keep wanting to swim with whales and we don't necessarily ensure the sustainability and longevity of it, are we killing the golden goose?
Now, you work with Colossal Bioscience Sciences that I'm a huge fan of. You know the team there at Colossal very nicely. One of the first things I talked to Peter Diamandis and some of the crew about when they were looking at financing Colossal a few years ago was, what is going to make you money? What's the point of bringing back a thylacine? What's the point of bringing back a woolly mammoth? What's going to make the money? And the first answer that I heard from a lot of folks around the table was zoo fees. Now, if I cross-pollinate that with when I was at the CES, this large technology show in Las Vegas, they already have direct ear-to-ear, like something out of Star Trek, direct language translation. So you could be speaking Italian to me, and I could be speaking English to you, and I would be hearing the English, and you would be hearing the Italian, and it's live. So now imagine your Tongan tourists in 10 years' time will have earbuds in, talking to Jen, talking to Jack, talking to Jeremy, all of the whales, and they will be hearing their whale song back.
Can I just say that as someone in the film industry who has been in a show called H2O Just Add Water.
Oh, yeah.
Dolphin actors, terrible, terrible. Never follow instruction. So to be able to go, yo, do this and do that and then that, I mean, that would be incredible. Free willy,
everyone. All over it. Benefit. So but this is like the cross-pollination of some of these technologies will come down to some of the legal questions we're having now about whales and their protection and their value, and it will actually start putting dollar values on things. And I hate to say it, but that's the
But then who will own the personhood of a whale? Whale influencers who are up there, and then...
Siali.
Like, yeah, Migaloo. who's going to...
Migaloo is already a whale influencer.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. All right, so...
It's one of those things, it's like, what's the best that could happen? And what's the worst that could happen if we can speak to animals currently living in the sea? You each have to answer.
I'm just going to quote, I think it might have been Paul McCartney or somebody that said if the slaughterhouses had microphones where you could hear the animals and they were speaking to you and screaming at you in English,
probably
would you
not
still eat meat? I'm a meat eater, so I'm just going to say, but I have been a vegan and I'm all over the place. But there's ways in which if we can actually physically have a conversation with a sentient being, that's going to change the foundation of society as we know it right now. That will upset every single foundation stone we have about what it means that Homo sapiens is on the top of the pyramid. We're not on the top of the pyramid. Those of us that work in nature realize we're part of the biocentricity. But for us to be knocked off that pedestal, that's going to
a little bit humbly.
Well, we always just assume that it's about what we can say to the animals and what they can say to us. We don't assume that what we're going to create is going to get them to be able to conspire against us as a separate thing. It's not what we can say to whales. It's what whales can say to turtles. Like, give me a lift up onto that beach. I'm going to take on the humans.
Those orcas in the Mediterranean. So there were some young orca lads. They got annoyed because their mother was killed by a yacht. And so what they do now is they're attacking all the posh yachts. They're going for the super yachts.
Are they doing that deliberately? See, this is a thing.
How can we prove it? Imagine now they say, we're going.
It's because they've got their hashtag eat the rich on their side.
No, but when they bite the rudder off a boat, because the boat makes a sound, the rudder moves, they bite it off, and then it stops and they go away. So from a behavioural point of view, is it just that, are they jilted or is it just the ultimate toy?
We have to ask them and find out.
We haven't asked them.
We have to ask them and find out. If I was to say to you, what's going to win, a great white shark or an orca?
I feel like this is a trick question, so I'm going to say orca.
Very good answer. So orcas figured out that they could turn great white sharks upside down and eat their liver. And when they eat the liver, the oil from the liver goes so far across the water that you then don't see a great white shark pretty much all season.
Very clever.
There's an article that came out in January 2026 that asked the fundamental question, do you think we can fully trust what AI says when the health of the ocean is at stake?
How we provide AI with the information.
If we can't fill the gaps, the AI
but
fills the gaps.
We don't know much about the ocean. Honestly, we don't. So how can we ask? It doesn't have the information to make those decisions.
I think it depends on the question that you're asking and who's asking it and which platform it's asking it on. If it's an open source, white labeled, an ability for everyone to disagree with it and interrogate it, and public discourse and researchers are going at it, it's very different to saying, here's an app that you click on and you scan this and it will tell you this. AI is a term for 1,000 different things. And so you do have to hone your question slightly down in that I think AI could be dangerous to make large conversations. But also, at the moment, the number of people that don't trust the basic planetary data that we've been telling them about, the amount of people that don't agree that climate change is real, and even though all of the scientists pretty much think that we know that anthropogenic climate change is a real thing. And that's before AI even came into the equation. So I guess maybe how can AI help decipher some of that information to convince those who aren't certain because they don't understand large data to be able to ask easier questions?
But sometimes
of
it's even set. Stuff. I was using I downloaded ChatGPT for my dad for his phone. I was showing him how to use it and I was like, look, it's great. What time's the next bus going from down the road? And it got it wrong. It got it, but that's the most obvious. Like, it's so easy to find that information. And ChatGPT's like, it doesn't leave till 6:59 tonight. And I'm like, no, that's wrong. And if it can't tell me when the bus is going to leave, how the hell is it going to know what a whale is saying? You know, like, that's, how am I going to trust it?
Yeah.
Hey, what did that whale say? And they'll be like, oh, the whale likes your new hat. And I'll be like, cool, thanks, whale. The whale's like, what the hell? I didn't say that, bro. Hate that hat.
Well, I won't keep you guys in suspense. Their answer conclusion is that yes, sort of, it helps heaps with data and stuff, but we're worried about transparency, validation, ethical alignment, misuse of data, da da da. So the answer is, of course, yeah, we like it because it helps us out, but also, ooh, we're super scared about these frameworks.
Your problem with what you gave your dad was you got him a free version, and quite frankly, the Transport New South Wales version is always wrong anyway.
You're going to have to pay
for everything. You have to pay for the service. But since when did you expect to pay for anything for free? Like, every single piece of software is developed and built by human hand and built by human businesses.
But you used to be able to call up TransLink and say, hey, when's the next bus? And there'd be someone going...
And that was paid for by your taxes. That was paid for by another mechanism.
I think we should be also considering, like, what is the worst that can happen and how can this be used against us? And, like, you know, I would have... You'd have to assume that it would be how will this be used in the sense of warfare? And how are people going to be able to poison waterways and take away keystone animals from, you know, environmental groups or whatever to really wage havoc on people?
Have we seen a fake stranding yet?
I've seen whale interaction.
This is it, disinformation and misinformation. So when people create fake videos, sometimes you can see where the label is on some of the video software. And we don't have some of the video software in Australia yet, so a lot of this is coming out of the United States.
And the behaviour of the whales doesn't correlate to what's happening. So this is just weird.
So you can tell, Vanessa.
I can tell as a whale scientist. I'm like, what the hell is a sperm whale doing with all these kids and it's opening its mouth and I'm like, is it dead? But no, people are interacting with it. That's not sperm
whale
behaviour.
But that's what I saw a video just the other day of someone who'd found these two little things in her backyard and she nursed them to life and they were sugar gliders and it was this sweet thing. And I was like, oh, okay. I look in the comments, everyone's like, slop. And I was like, man, I believe it. Like, I was like, oh my God, I'm old.
The post-truth is interesting. And look, we've seen this after some pretty hideous stuff. We've seen it after bushfires. We've seen it even after the attack in Bondi, fake videos being generated. And so when we think about the ocean side of the disinformation and misinformation conversation, I am surprised it's only two things that you have been sent, because we're at the start where people are taking things that are genuine truths and twisting them and doing it for clicks and doing it for shares and likes. And this is the problem of monetization and the incentivization for people to just produce content that gets interaction rather than verifying what the content is. So I actually say that is a clear and present danger, is not just the accidental hallucination of generative AI systems, but the purposeful misdirection and misinformation created.
So what's our one sentence only recommendation for the future of AI in your area?
Take it with a grain of salt. Remember, we have experts in this field. Consult the experts.
In terms of the future of AI from my sort of like large data space ocean futures perspective, this might be the most powerful technology that we have ever got our hands on. Please tear it to pieces.
In a good way or a bad way?
In a great way. Put it to bits. Put it to bits. Find where it breaks. And write to your MP the fact that we don't have decent funding for sovereign AI in Australia.
I just want it to be known that I had nothing against any animals in the ocean. I've always been a fan of them all, and I've also always been a fan of AI. I know this is going on YouTube. There's going to be some bot learning it. I'm cool with you, AI, robots. I've always been a fan of yours, and yeah. Remember me.
Thank you all so much. That was so much fun.
Those panellists again were Matt O'Kine, a man with two mothers, his own and the other from Mother and Son, Dr. Vanessa Perotta, a Eureka Prize winner, and Dr. Catherine Ball, a futurist, with Emily Jatiff as host. And she dives deep to film the Titanic and other shipwrecks.
Next week, a Science Show special, the launch of the first inventors and how people first came to Australia even earlier than 65,000 years ago, the date we know. Evidence about how many came, in what numbers, and even the sheer size of the ancient human population here. That's next week, with those from the Centre of Excellence who've done most of the research.
Oh, that sounds fascinating, Robin. I can't wait to hear it. I'm Belinda Smith.
And I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.